in this photograph, we recognize the Andromeda Galaxy, and it occurs in this book, which you should have a copy of, called Galaxies. And this book is one of two books, the second of which is The Particle Explosion. And you should have both these books together. And these two books form a bookend. And all of what we are talking about now fits in between this bookend. And we're going to use this bookend for only 4 weeks. And then we're going to set it down, and we're going to use another pair of books, which are not here today, but they'll be here. And we do this procedure exactly like a yoga each month, only 4 times, so that there are only 4 cardinal locations that are demarked by 4 lectures. There's a lecture which begins it. There's a lecture that is halfway. And there are 2 lectures that are articulate spots in between, halfway to the half and halfway to the return. So that there is a circle of learning. And when there's a circle of learning, then you have a geometry which allows you to have a picture in your mind. Without a geometry, there is no image that records, and you see nothing. And when you can see nothing, there's no structure, there are no bones upon which to build an education. And so one has to train oneself in this yoga. You have to bear down each week and realize that each week is 1/4 of a circle, and each 4 weeks is another circle. And that eventually what comes out is a recognizable pattern that in no way is just simply a collection of circles. What comes out is very similar to this kind of pattern. This photograph is of a nuclear particle called the electron coming into a bubble chamber of liquid hydrogen. And these circles are the orbits that the electron makes in that bubble chamber. Now, in a real education, in a real yoga of learning, the mind in reality, realistically, does not record itself. The mind is like the deepest vacuum you can imagine. It makes no record of itself. This has been proved many times by men and women around this world throughout tens of thousands of years, that there are states of experience where you have just mind only, and when that happens, nothing records. It's not the nothing of the daydream, it's the precise recording that nothing is recording. Now, an education which is worth anything at all takes this into consideration, and always starts with a zero base. The difference between an education and an instruction is that an instruction always begins by telling you something. You understand? When you are told something and you understand it, oh, that's what you told me. That's instruction. This is in no way education. It's a very serious point. Instruction always makes you respond to what you are told. And if you get used to only having a reality of a response to what you are told, you're going to be manipulated. 100% sure you're going to be manipulated by whoever instructs you. Now, what's wrong with life is that everyone is conditioned in exactly this way, with a few exceptions. And the exceptions are people who struggled to get free of the instruction glue. Now, this in no way is instruction. You are told many things that you don't understand. You don't hear it. You don't understand it. You can't make a picture of it. Let it flow. Because what we are noticing here is a movement within the mind. And just as in this electron micrograph, the movement of the electron does not show the electron, only its track in the bubble chamber. Only its 36 times zipping around by the time the photograph has completed itself in just microseconds. Our education makes a circle each month, and over a period of 2 years, we will have 24 circles. We'll have 24 tracks which will show us the path that our learning has taken, that our education is the path of learning, the movement of something that learns, something that knows, something that can be educated, but is so quick, is so dynamic, that you cannot photograph it. The spirit is very quick. In medieval times, the symbol for it was quicksilver because it changes shape so quickly, and that's a very poor metaphor. The spirit is much faster than quicksilver. The hand is faster than the eye. Do you know that? A parlor magician can move his hand in a staccato kind of way, and your eye cannot see the little sub-movements that are put into the general staccato form. You don't even see the little movement to the side because it's done in such a way to cover it. The eye, which is in a human being who has been instructed, cannot tell when there is a subtle movement buried in the cover. But to someone who is completely natural, they cannot be tricked by parlor magic. There's no such thing as the magician doing little movements that the natural eye does not pick up. The natural eye sees everything as it is. Perception is clean and pure. What veils perception is instruction, which manipulates you into looking with veils so that your mind does not see what's there, but only what you are trained to see. And you are trained not only just to see certain things, but to see them in certain ways only. You cannot see them rotated 360 degrees. Whereas someone who has natural sight will see every capacity, every angle, all at once. Someone who is trained in herbology has read all the herbal manuals, goes out into nature, and is instructed, full like telephone book, to see, oh, this is used for such and so, such and so. Whereas someone who is completely natural, completely no instruction, yet has lived in nature, lived with herbs, they can creatively, spontaneously tell that they need this now because it calls out to them. Choose me now for this. This is the difference between education and instruction. But to have an education takes patience. Because the very first part of an education, you don't know what's going on. You don't understand. And by my watch that I don't wear, this is exactly the right timing. If you understood what I'm saying now completely, you're in the wrong place. Get out. Go and live. You don't need it. But if you cannot hear everything, you hear just a few things, stay and return and return and return and return. Now, it's true that there are pitfalls in just returning. And so the very next level, we take 3 months in nature and then we go to a higher level. The very next level is ritual. Why the very next level, ritual? Because we need to pay attention to the fact that repeating has its own pitfalls, and we need to be wise to watch out for them. And so on the very next level, on ritual, 3 more circles. 3 circles on nature, then 3 circles on ritual. And when we do 3 circles on ritual, we will learn that we have to watch out for language, that language has pitfalls also. And immediately our ears have to go up and we have to be aware that we have to now do 3 circles on language and that the essence of language is myth. Now we're on nature and there'll be many levels after that. There are 8 levels altogether. 3 circles on each of 8 levels, 24 circles. They will not be in the same place. They will always have this kind of configuration. Because the only way they can be on the very same place so that you only have 1 thick circle is if you are completely indoctrinated and you have no creativity whatsoever. That the naturalness has been beaten out of you by perfect instruction. Such a person is like a machine, and a machine will make a perfect circle each and every time, no deviation. So that the ultimate purpose of an instruction is to approximate a machine. Do you want that? And the purpose of an education is to mature a spirit. You need that. Now, this is a serious endeavor. It's not like getting ready to go for a vacation or even getting ready to go for work. This is something that when you do it all the time. The punctuation of being here on Saturday is a punctuation of simply showing up. But the rest of the week is a preparation for this event. And you do it any way that you want to do, but increasingly become aware that you are preparing to be prepared. And when you come here on Saturday, be prepared. Be on time. Don't be late. Don't miss so much. It's a yoga. Do you think that if you're sitting in meditation and you're scratching and you're moving, that anything is going to happen? Nothing. You won't even get to first samadhi where you feel okay, much less to the deep rapture where one begins to hum with vibration of reality. When you realize everything is alive, everything is moving, the whole planet is moving. It's moving in a ballet with our star. And the star and this planet and several other planets, 8 or 9 other planets in this star, are all in a ballet. And that whole ensemble, that whole choreographed ensemble of these dancers of the star and its planets is also moving with other stars. There's a whole cluster of local stars, 25, 30 stars that move together. We don't know where they came from. We don't know where they're going. But they move together like a family. It's incredible. When you look in the night sky and you see one of the brightest stars, Sirius, that deep blue star, is about 7 light years away. And it's not just a single star, but has a little white dwarf companion that goes around. It's a double star. And one thinks at first, what a strange thing. There are binary stars. And after a little education, you learn that most stars are multiple. There are more multiple stars than there are single stars. Our sun is a single star. Not only binaries, but there are triples. The closest star to us is 3 stars together. Alpha Centauri, which you can see in the sky, has 2 other companions. The closest star to us is a triple star, and the next closest star is a double star. This should tell you something about the nature of the universe. That differential proliferation is the rule. And if you are a kind of a person who is living on machine-like circles with no differentiation, you are an exception to nature. You're an exception to the universe. You're part of a huge ocean, a gang about 6 billion strong called exceptionistes. There are always exceptions. Oh yes, it's all right for them, but not for me. I am an exception. And everyone is an exception. Because they have been indoctrinated, they have been instructed in this way to approximate to the single circle, when actually reality is gorgeously different. Now this education pays attention with the ears, with the eyes, with the mind. Pays attention to a fantastically wild universe. And we like to get educated so we can be at home in more and more of it. And as we become more natural to nature, we get the feeling of reality, that what we do has oomph to it. It gets done really. And we'll see that action is the essence of ritual. And action has a quality which the Chinese used to call te. I think in Farsi the word is had. It's a powerful thusness that happens. It actually works. It actually gets done. Te. It means that whatever has action, whatever has movement, has a thusness to it, and the thusness has a palpable quality of oneness, of unity. And that this unity is the oneness that all the thousands and millions of spirit books talk about. The oneness, the universe, one place, one thing, one situation, uni. The unity, so that unity has a weight, whereas the mind participates in something deeper than unity. The mind is of the nature of nature, and nature is not like ritual where it has unity. Nature has a mysteriousness. It has mystery. So deeper than unity is mystery. The mind is of mystery. What is the mind made up? It's made up of mystery. No one knows. We give a designation and say that nature is zero-based, whereas existence is unified. All existence is unified, not unified by kind of cards it carries, not unified by the type of instruction which is somehow filtered through, if you could do it. No, it's unified by the fact of its existence, that all existence, even the word existence, it's a unity. It's the universe, all that exists. And out of that unity, because it is dynamic against zero, because the one is dynamic with zero, the zero and one are a pair. They are a binary. And because they are a pair, they produce, they are fertile, they produce everything. With a one and a zero, you can eventually write almost anything. It's like a computer program. You can refine it almost indefinitely. So that the first pair is zero and one, nature and existence. And nature and existence being a pair, they always go together. In the 1950s, there was a rock and roll song. And one of the lyrics, the phrases was, "We go together like two straws in a Coke." Huh? Every time you sip from one, you get Coke from the other. A pair. And so zero and one, you never sip and just taste zero. You never sip and just taste one. It's always both together. And because they're together and they are different, there is a dynamic, and the dynamic has movement, and the movement carries not only oneness, but carries zero with it. So wherever there is movement, there is also quiet in the midst of the movement. One can master this like a magician who carries zero with his movement, and he can work in between the one some zero reflexes as a subset action, and you can't perceive it unless you're totally natural. This education is a way of returning back, purifying ourselves slowly. Just let the weeks go by. Let me polish. What am I polishing? I'm not polishing your instruction. You don't need to know more things. You know enough things. What I'm polishing is to get rid of the things. I'm wiping away rather than making it shine. Oh, I mentioned something in instruction, and oh yeah, I know about that. Oh, that guy is smart. He knows what I know. What kind of foolishness is this? Huh? It's an arcade game. Pin the tail on the donkey. It's worthless. Whereas a real education is this kind of movement that after a while you will notice in the gestalt of yourself a pattern which is particularly yours, which you did not see before. There it is, revealed. And once it's revealed, it's indelible because it doesn't go away. It's not a veil which is there because the instruction is putting it there. No, it's not there just temporarily because the situation is evoking it. It's there because it is you. Wherever you are, then, you have a consciousness of your gestalt, the way that you are. And when you have that consciousness of your gestalt, you pick up right away that someone else has a reality to them. They are similar to you in that they also have a gestalt of wholeness, but it's a little different. And so you notice that there's nothing like identity, but there's always similarity. And we talked last week about the virtues of substituting the law of similarity for the law of identity. With similarity, possibility becomes real. With identity, only the absolute would be real. And if you narrow down life so that reality only records with absolute precision, you're going to weed everybody out, including yourself, at all times. What kind of a situation is this? This is an expectation which is stupid. So that the exceptionistes belong to, they are a subset of the tribe of the ignorati. So next time you are proud that you're an exception, think about the parentage and the lineage. Okay, I'm stiff-arming a little bit this morning because so many are not here. I mean, in this cycle, in this flow. Each month, we have a different pair of books that we use. Why are we using books? Because for the last 2,000 years on this planet, the way in which the mind has disclosed its patterns has been recorded primarily in this medium. Now, we live in a time, in a generation, where this is shifting. It's going to go into electronic networks, but not yet. The weight of 2,000 years is in the books. And before we can get to that high new level, we have to master this old first. Because one of the principles in the universe is that you cannot rise to a higher energy level until you fill a previous energy level completely. It's the lesson of the electron. An electron cannot move into higher energy orbit until that orbit is completely saturated. When that orbit energy level is filled, then there can be a movement to a higher level. The same in this education. Until you have filled that those circles of mystery, you don't get any traction in the higher circles of action. And the novice wonders, what good is this kind of education? What good are spirit teachings? Nothing changes. Nothing changed for you because you didn't fill the energy levels of mystery first. If you tend to the mystery first, then the actions become very efficacious. This is a principle of a yoga. You can sit for 500 years and nothing will be different until your samadhi is deep. And when it's deep enough and full enough, the slightest anything works like charm. There was a famous Japanese Zen master about 100 years ago. He was 19 years old. He was not yet Zen master, but very close. His name was D.T. Suzuki. In Japan, about 100 years ago, he got a big letter from a famous professor in Chicago. Come to United States. We pay your way. We pay everything. We're going to make a translation. We're going to make a translation of Tao Te Ching, Chinese classic. We need someone who reads English and also reads Chinese and also has mastered Tao and meditation. We heard from your teacher that you are the best new diamond for meditation. We need you. So he took the letter to his teacher. His teacher said, of course you can go, but not until you are finished. You have a little more mystery that you have to finish. And because you have had this invitation, and the boat leaves on such and such a day, you only have 3 days. And as your teacher, I tell you that if you don't finish your meditation, deepen your samadhi so that it's permanent in 3 days, not only can you not go, but you must kill yourself. Hari Kari, suicide, because that was the old Japanese way. And so he had this tension, the young D.T. Suzuki. And at the last minute of the last night, when he thought, well, I couldn't do it, he gave up. And exactly at that moment, what was different? He wrote when he was 95. He wrote the difference. He said, I looked down in the zendo, in the meditation hall. He said, I looked down and all of a sudden I was transparent. I could see through my body. And he said he rose without any effort. He went to the door of the zendo. He opened the door and looked out. He said, all the trees were transparent. Everywhere he looked, the world was transparent. It no longer had the veils of appearance that matter usually gives us. Why? Why does matter usually look opaque, solid? We take pride, we say, it's solid. The ignorati are numerous and indelibly stupid. That's no guarantee of reality whatsoever, because the reality is that in between the nucleus of the atom and the electrons is just open space. And that's only on electromagnetic energy that powers this kind of matter. There are many other kinds of matter. There are many other kinds of energy. There are whole other ecologies that are quite different. This is knocking on the door of stupidity. Because when you are really returned back to zero, base, nature, everything is transparent. You look and your looking itself penetrates. And whatever you look to see, you penetrate more and more. The American sage Black Elk, when he was a little boy of 9 and had his deep cleansing of his eyes, of his mind, deep disease, his parents took him to a shaman. The shaman said, you have to leave him alone. He will either die or he will come through, because you get to a certain place and it's one or the other. And you have to set everything aside. You can't take anything with you. You have to face that decision. Nothing or everything. And it turns out that in logic, all and nothing, infinity and zero, are exchangeable. And it would be, if you flip a coin, exactly 50-50 that you have nothing or you have everything. But a wisdom education shows you that the zero and infinity being exchangeable are not just exceptions at the far ends of a spectrum of everything in between, but that existence carries zero with it all the time. And because zero is with oneness all the time, infinity is there all the time also. You understand me? Infinity is there all the time with existence. You don't have to go somewhere else, but it's a maturity of the here and now. You've heard the phrase, what does it mean? But you've heard the phrase through instruction. It's not it. The form by which you know interferes with the known. And so one has to know in a form that's commensurate with what knowing is. And the knower moves so quickly that the hands are very slow, even though the hands are quicker than the eye. They're quicker than the unnatural eye. One artist, his name was Paul Klee, he said that an artist has a thinking eye. That when the artist looks, the eye thinks as it looks. It has visual intelligence. That eye is quicker than the hands. But even that eye, which is quicker than the hands, the mind is quicker than that eye. Why? Because the mind is instantaneous. There's no time lapse whatsoever. As quick as you can move your hand, as quick as the natural eye can move, which is almost imperceptibly fast, the mind beats it all the time because it doesn't move at all. It's instantaneous. The spirit lives in that realm. And so when you slow the spirit down to the realm of instruction that's even less than hands, you are binding it with ropes like some captive mummy. And you drag your spirit through this life like a prisoner, for shame. Stop being stupid. When the teaching is available and there, sponge it up. You don't need to go and get fancy containers to hold it. Just be there again and again and again. And you will see after a while that the circles, while they are similar, they are not exact, thank God. Now we're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back and we'll do the rest of the lecture. Thank you. This is the Andromeda galaxy, which we started off the day with, and we'll start the second half. Notice that the presentation each time is a pair of lectures that come together with an interval in between. This structure is universal. This is the structure of pacing receptivity. Receptivity is always carries with it a punctuation, an interval of articulation in the center. This is why the ancient Chinese symbolized receptivity by a broken line, a line that has a space in the middle, a line that has the space in the middle. Now, the very ancient Chinese understood that this space in the middle, which characterizes receptivity, is something which occurs in the midst of movement, so that movement carries hidden within it stillness. And that this pair of movement and stillness, the stillness in the middle of movement, must also then have a pair where stillness carries within the middle of it movement. So they put them together, and they realize that when you are talking about something which is fundamental, you're talking about a structure which has a quality where zeroness occurs, and within zeroness, oneness moves. And when you have the zero and the one together, they together produce another pair, and that other pair is movement that has stillness in the center and stillness that has movement in the center. So that when you put it all together, you have a pair of pairs. A pair of pairs. And that this pair of pairs takes into consideration not only what exists, but the mystery behind existence already. And that the further pair of pairs somehow expresses both what exists and the mystery together in the relationship of their further development into a second pair. Now, paying attention with natural perception, with no instructional veils, but natural perception, one notices then, just by taking that in, that pairedness produces pairedness, but that the further pairedness occurs in three parts. Movement, stillness, movement. One, two, three. Stillness, movement, stillness. One, two, three. So that natural perception, the clear mind, the clean seeing, notices that the structure of threeness occurs in a pair. There are two threes, and they pair up. And this comes out of a primordial pair that's zero and one. So on the first level, you have mystery and existence, zero and one. And on the next level, you have a pair of triads, movement with stillness in the center and stillness with movement in the center, and that those two somehow crisscross. So that the ancient Chinese way of symbolizing this was to have a trigram and to bring two trigrams together to make a hexagram. And so the I Ching, which we started our education with, one of the books we started with was the I Ching. Its pair was Thoreau, the American natural sage. Thoreau and the I Ching. In the I Ching, the gestalt that carries the workable understanding of natural perception is the hexagram. Six lines arranged in a pair of three-line trigrams, a pair of trigrams. And each of those trigrams is composed simply of two kinds of line, an unbroken line or a broken line. The broken line being not broken, notice the language is defective. There's nothing broken about receptivity. And if you misidentify, now notice the power of the language. If you misidentify receptivity with a woman, women are receptive, therefore they're weak in the middle, they're broken. The language deludes you and leads you far away from any kind of truth. One has to watch language like you're watching bad children. Language runs away with us. Why does it do this? Because the language is pumped into us when we are little before we can defend ourselves. And we are indoctrinated even before we realize that the spoons that are feeding us a kind of a gruel. And that this taste for this gruel is making us idiots in an ignorant situation that's always wrong. So no wonder by the time that we're of an age like 2 or 3 to begin to notice what's going on, you see what little children, what do little boys and girls do at that age? They say no. They go through the terrible phrase. No. Do you want some food? No. Even though they are starved to death. No. Because their gut reaction, it's like a vomiting. Already by 3 years old, human being understands something is murky. It's not right. So an education like this is like a stream that purifies itself by running, but it has to run a while in order to work. Give it a chance. You don't hear everything the first day. You don't hear everything first month, even first year. But eventually, if you give it enough continuity, the process is refined enough. Not just because I put 30 years in, but because there's about 30 centuries of human experience in this, it'll run clear. By running clear, I don't mean that there are no problems, but one sees the problems for what they are, and you don't mistake them for something else. You don't look for an identification, which even if you could get would be wrong. And it helps the blood pressure to stop looking for something that even if you got it, would just electrocute you. So you get into all kinds of binds. You're forcing yourself to look specifically and only for something which if you got it, would already electrocute you. So something deep in you is forbidding you from doing this, is bad for you, but it can't speak, it doesn't know how to say, so it just gets in the way as resistance. And then you use more willfulness to overcome that resistance. God damn it, I'm going to have it. And only that will do. Get out of my way, everybody else. And when you build that up on several different levels already, you have a confusion enough to drive a person crazy. So if you're crazy, don't worry about it. It's only natural you should be crazy. What else are you going to be? So in very ancient times, this ignorance is not the product of American civilization. It's not the product of Western civilization. It's in the process of the way in which beings like ourselves get enmeshed in a universe that occurs in the complexity in which it happens. So in most ancient times that we know of, how ancient? The most ancient times that we know of is about 200,000 years ago, because we have complete burial of 200,000 years ago. The burial, incidentally, is on Mount Carmel in what is today Israel, what was in ancient times Palestine, and what was 200,000 years ago, just a part around the lake that was the Mediterranean Sea. On that mountain, because Carmel is high enough, it was above the water, it was like an island. And the species of man that lived on that island buried on the top of Mount Carmel, and a grave site was found there. 200,000 years ago. And in there, only two things were still there. One thing that was there was the bones, the skeleton of that, it was called Homo Neanderthal, that species of man. The bones were there, and dotted around the bones, around the form of the skeleton, were the seeds of the flowers, because the body had been surrounded by flowers in the shape of the person. So only the flower seeds and the bones remained. And we know that the most ancient image which men and women used when they woke up from their ignorance and became perceptive of the transparency of nature, they used the skeleton, they used bones as a symbol for being able to see through the ignorance, through the appearance. And so the most ancient costume of intelligent men and women, they were always rare, had bones sewed to the outside of the skins, that they had been turned inside out. And the wise woman, the wise man, the old shaman or the old shamaness wore their skeleton on the outside to show that they had turned themselves inside out. They brought the stillness in the midst of movement out, and they brought the movement in the midst of stillness out. But everybody else, just like today, they don't want to touch it. They don't want to be turned inside out. Because being ignorant is very comfortable. Because all the blankets of habitual situations make you convinced that this is the better way. That's dangerous. That's difficult. And so every response from ignorance is not to hear anything that's going to upset the boat. Why do people not wake up? Because they don't want to wake up. Not because they don't understand. They understand perfectly well. And they don't want to do it. It's just like a Tibetan Vajrayana arbitrator who was arbitrating arguing groups in Europe one time, and he stood up and he announced to them, he said, "You're all mistaken. You think that you disagree because you don't understand each other, when it's quite apparent that you disagree because you do understand each other and don't want to agree. You don't need an arbitrator. You're never going to agree." And he walked out. He left them. And it shocked them, because it was true. On the deepest level, they knew it. They didn't agree because they didn't understand each other, but because they did. That's why they fight. At this stage of our education, we are trying to turn ourselves inside out instead of being surrounded by all the shells of habitual instruction, by the assumed situations that embalm us. We're trying to pull ourselves out of the middle of that and turn it inside out. And so we're talking about galaxies. Because on level of galaxies, this is large scale enough that there's no habit yet on this level. It's only been about three generations that anyone has even understood that these objects are there. And the first person to understand this is what is there, this is what is really out there, was a man named Hubble, right here in Los Angeles, up on Mount Wilson. He wrote a book in the 1930s called The Realm of the Nebulae. They used to be called nebula. Nebula because the Latin term nebula means clouds. Cloudy, clouds. They weren't clear like stars. They were just clouds, nebula. Here in Los Angeles, about 60 years ago is the first time that someone patiently watching night after night, month after month, year after year, let the receptivity penetrate that, wait a minute, these are not nebula. They have shapes. It's just that the shapes are so far away that they seem, the appearance seems like clouds, but with 100-inch telescope at Mount Wilson, could focus and see that they're not clouds at all, but they are spirals. Most of them spirals. And so Hubble published in early 1930s the Hubble Atlas of Galaxies. It was like an atlas, like a map, instead of a map of the Earth, a map of the deep heavens. The deep heavens, how deep? Andromeda Galaxy is 2 million light years away. If you could go as fast as speed of light, it would take 2 million years to get there. That cemetery on Mount Carmel is only 1/10 as old, 200,000 years. But on level of galaxies, where there's no habituation yet, there's only turned inside out freedom, where the spirit can be exactly what it is, we recognize that there, all the stars that we see, except for a few faint nebula, very few faint nebula, all the stars that we see are a part of another structure very much like this, which if we could be 2 million years away would look something like this, and that we live in a galaxy, and the galaxy is called the Milky Way. Why? Because the most ancient name for this river of light that goes through, especially in primordial regions of the Earth, a little further south, one sees this kind of nebula that goes very elongated across the whole sky. It's looking on edge through a whole galaxy which we are in, and that Milky Way is a cross-section of where we are, and that this entire structure moves. It also has a ballet. Remember we were talking about the sun, about our star and its planets that do a ballet, and that there are many stars that move as a family, as a cluster, and they do their ballet. So the entire galaxy does its ballet and moves. And that our sun is far enough out from the center of the Milky Way galaxy that it takes 200 million years to make one circle. You could make 100 trips to Andromeda Galaxy in the time that it takes to make one swing. And that this galactic structure has been extant just long enough for us to make about 9 complete circles. So that in a way, the universe is like a child yet, 9 years old, just waking up to its spiritual capacity. And that just perhaps what's wrong is that reality is not finished yet. Perhaps it's just young. And that when it gets a little more mature, spirits will be free everywhere at all times. When someone has clear perception all the way through penetration, all the way through all these structures, one gets an ebullience. It's called joy, but it's deeper than joy. It's called rapture. It's deeper than rapture. It's a quality of effortless certainty that this is what is true. That eventually all matter will wake up and sing when it is mature. This is the patience of the wise on this scale. Not that you just endure insults for a few seconds on one planet around one star and one little group. They're hurting your feelings, are they? They cut you out of traffic. Ejo de biche. On the scale of opening up where the spirit is free, mystery and unity always are together, and each carries the other in the center of it. So that the Chinese Tai Chi symbol has a little circle of light in the dark and a little circle of dark in the light. And the ancient Egyptian symbol was always this infinity sign, that interpenetrating pair of zero and infinity. Now, this quality we will talk about next week as the spiral spirit archetype, that the waking up to this symbol just 60 years ago, the coming to understand that this Andromeda galaxy, which we see through telescopes so clearly, this nice photograph here shows that the Andromeda galaxy and our own Milky Way galaxy are like a pair. They're very large. And they are like stars. They have families. And surrounding our galaxy are nine little other smaller galaxies, galactic structures. And surrounding Andromeda are about six other little satellite galactic structures. And there are about another five little galactic structures that are further out, not around either. So that all together, there's a whole family of about 22 galactic structures dominated by two huge galaxies, our own and Andromeda, and that they also move together through an even vaster space. And that if you took circles of radius at intervals of 1 million light years, and you go out to a radius of just three circles, 3 million light years, so the diameter is 6 million light years, you could encompass all 22 of these celestial objects into a single family that move as a unit. They move as a gestalt in a space that's much wider. And when you get to the much wider space, we see now through much more powerful telescopes than Hubble was using. Hubble and several of his friends, when they first were making these discoveries in the 1930s, began to tell the government officials in Washington, D.C., we think there are more surprises if we could look deeper, but we need larger telescopes. And after World War II was over, funds were made to make a 200-inch telescope, Mount Palomar. And the lead figure there was a man named Hale, George Elroy Hale. And Hale and Hubble together really pioneered a whole generation of curiosity, not just because they are Americans, but at that time in 1940s, Americans had the money. They had the spirit, the know-how. So they did it. And with Mount Palomar, the 200-inch telescope, a huge atlas was prepared of the deep sky. And they found that galaxies exist not just in 20s, not even in hundreds, but in millions. millions. Harvard University published a galactic map that had 6 million galaxies plotted on it. And you can still buy it, I think, from Harvard University. We know now, because of a huge telescope called the Hubble telescope, named for that man, that orbits the Earth and looks even deeper, much deeper than 200-inch Mount Palomar, much deeper, that there are billions, billions of galaxies, and that there are structures so vast that takes half a billion light years to make the structure. And that the structure is that there are huge bubbles of nothing. And around the perimeter, around the sphere of these huge bubbles of nothing, galaxies collect like foam. And these voids and foam are part of some huge, enormous, super immense structure that is there. Who knows? So they cut you off in traffic. The perspective that we're working with today is not only with the vastness of galactic dimensions and extragalactic structures, but that this also is mirrored. It's complemented. It's paired with levels that are like the large, but they are small. And on these small levels, what occurs more and more is exactly the same as the larger, so that the smaller is like the larger, as above, so below. And on the nuclear particle level, where existence really has its stuff, it also goes deeper and deeper into mystery and disappears. It disappears not into ambiguity, not into vagueness, but it disappears into high energy, the highest energy zero imaginable, so that zero is not some kind of nothing wimp, but that in actual fact, the zero of mystery is highest energy of all. And closer one gets to that high energy, the more the mystery unambiguously occurs, deeper than existence, more primordial than the one. That's the way it was described 1700 years ago in Alexandria in Egypt. More primordial than the one, deeper than the unknown. Occurrence happens. And what occurs is not anything but mystery that is actual. So we have learned so far, this is just the 8th lecture out of 104, just beginning. We've learned that to be realistic, we must begin with zero-based mystery and to always factor it in, whatever is going on, and to remember to do so. And as we remember to do so, we can symbolize it for ourselves by this pair of triads, one that has a broken line, which is a terrible way to talk about receptivity, and one that has an unbroken line, which is a terrible way to talk about continuity, but that's how the language has come. And that when you pair these together, they do not just pair in twos, but the structure builds in threes, so that when you have structure, a triad is the most basic, and when you have process, a pair is the most basic. So that the triangle is the most basic form in the universe, and the line is the most basic process. And that when one lets lines go natural, they become spiral-like. So that when one is dealing with line, one has to understand that it isn't like ruler straight line, but it's a sinuous moving line that has universal propensity that electrons always turn clockwise. All electrons always spiral clockwise, and that the pair to the electron, the positron, always curls anticlockwise. And so, like in this particular photograph, one has here the electron curling clockwise and the positron, the anti-electron, coming down off the page. The discovery of the positron happened in 1932, about the same time as the discovery of galaxies. So the first new particle accompanied at the same time of the realization of the first new structure beyond stars. That the galaxy and the positron occurred together, same time. That this was so mysterious at the time that there were only a handful of human beings who even could receive this, could understand this. And they argued among themselves as to what this could mean, naturally. Mm-hmm. One of the peculiar qualities that we learn from I Ching is that you cannot talk about positive and minus first. You cannot talk about yin and yang first. There's a second order. It's a second order of structure, that there's a deeper order of structure, and the deeper order is Tao and Te. Zero and one are deeper than plus and minus. The electron is a minus energy charge. The positive energy charge is not the positron. It would be the positive energy charge in a universe that was energized enough to allow it to exist, but this universe that we live in now has gone through a process of cooling, quote, cooling. The ambient background temperature in the universe is 3 degrees Kelvin, 3 degrees above absolute zero. It's very cold. No? Very cold. No earmuffs possible. But once upon a time, we know, because we can see the line of movement, that the universe was super hot. Not only hotter than 3 degrees Kelvin or 500 degrees Kelvin or 1 million degrees Kelvin, but many, many billions. And at that temperature, positrons were the pair to electrons. But in the cool universe that we live in today, the pair to the electron is the proton. So the proton is the positive and the electron is the negative. So we know that in nature, not only do pairs exist, but that their relationality changes through circumstance, through phases. And so we have to learn what phase are we in to get the way in which the polarity of existence is operating, and to always realize that the polarity of existence is always conditional on a previous situation which is deeper and more primordial, and that the deepest circumstance of all is mystery and existence, Tao and Te, zero and one. So that plus and minus, positive and negative, yin and yang, are at least second order, a second phase, and that beyond them there are other phases that occur. Is this new? Is this because of nuclear physics? 2,500 years ago, a Chinese named Lao Tzu wrote this: Tao produces unity, unity produces paredness, paradness produces triads. Triads produce the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things bear yin to embrace yang. So it's been around a while. It came just at the time when he says triads produce multiplicity. The phrase 10,000 in ancient Chinese means multiplicity. When triangles produce multiplicity, 500 BC in China, at the very same time, 500 BC in Greece, Pythagoras is figuring out that a special kind of a triangle, a right angle triangle, always has a 3, 4, 5 side. At the same time, just like the positron in the galaxies found at the same time, also China and Greece, at the very same time, understanding that triadedness, the triangle, has a archetypal instance that if you follow it very purely, you get an equivalence. What is the equivalence? The equivalence is that with a triangle that has a 90 degree angle in it, the right angle triangle, that the square of the two little sides equals the one side square, the longer one. They are not identical, but they're equivalent. They are similar in their equivalency of volume, but they are in no way identical. So one has to cut really sharp now to be realistic and not be fooled. Identity as a goal of measurement is misleading. It's going to take you away from something that is realistic. It's going to take you to an expectation for absolutes that's frankly irrational. Whereas the rational is to understand that the similarity is much more workable, deeper to truth, and more viable to actuality. You can work with similarity almost all the time. Whereas identity is tyrannical and it works you to get to only one condition. Why settle for an impossible one when you can work with all everything else? And we've learned that nature has this quality, that nature is practical. Nature is very practical and works with mystery and unity all the time in a pair. A special pair, like the right triangle, a pair where the two are exchangeable, and that the exchangeability of mystery and unity happens with equivalence, with equanimity. That when you have an equanimity, then the equivalent quality, rather than being identical, allows for the special case of similarity to be completely balanced and thus exchangeable, interchangeable. So that 0 and 1 interchange their places at the special case of complete equanimity. And so the Chinese understood that we are at a place of equanimity. They call that Zhen. The human place is the place of the equanimity of mystery and unity. And when we arrange our third place in balance, 0 and 1 can work in each other's field. The mystery works in existence, and existence occurs in mystery. And in this way, man became really wise. Not just wise, but wisely wise, which is why the scientific label of our species is Homo sapiens sapiens. Wisdom is repeated, not as a redundancy, but as an exponential. We are not just wise, we are wisely wise. Our species is not just made to know, but to know that we know. We can learn to learn. We can be prepared to be prepared. So when we're really mature, let's face it, 2,000 years ago in Alexandria, one of the sharpest minds of the time said, when man is full in his splendor, even the angels applaud because man is much higher than angels. To which of the angels did God ever say, you are part of my family? No, they are messengers. You go and take this message there. But man is family. He belongs to the essence of heaven. And the essence of heaven belongs with him. Not just when, but all the time. So the ancient wisdom saying was that eternity is wherever you realize it. God is a circle whose center is everywhere. There are many ways to say this. But the wise thing in an education is to be alert and not forget, because the most difficult thing of all when you're beginning is to forget. Forgetfulness is the beginning of ignorance. Remembrance is the beginning of wisdom. And so the remembrance quality, that remembering to remember, is the basic quality that used to be called tying the string around your finger, binding together what you know into a unity. And that binding, that tying, that making sure that you remember to remember, that quality of cinching happens not on the level of nature, because you can't cinch anything in nature. It's always fluid. It's a matrix of change. You cannot cinch in nature. So where we learn to cinch was in our doing, in our action. You cinch in what you do. So the ritual level is where you cinch it. And the phenomena that occurs at the center of the cinching action of ritual is the body. And so the body is the string around the finger in the universe. Our bodies, we are the string around the finger of the universe. To cinch, it's remembering to remember. And so if we don't perform our function, the universe is stupid. It's completely lost in ignorance. What kind of responsibility are we shirking? The angels can't do one damn thing, excuse the pun, if they can't remember what message to carry, what's going on. And so we're very important. We're not little throwaways. In the decadent days of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, in the Iraq of about 2000, 3000 BC, in that mythological family of the powers and the gods, man was a little sweat drop at the edge of the margin. It's nothing. And so it was nothing to flick human beings away at that time. Whereas at the very same time, just across the Zagros Mountains, Zarathustra, understanding precisely that it's only in man's ultimate central quiet that one hears the openness of mystery and existence interpenetrating. And when one has that tone, that pitch pipe tuning, one can hear the whole spectrum of how movement and stillness play a harmonic. And the Gathas of Zarathustra, at the very same time, do not consider man a fleck of sweat on the margin, but as the soul core that's able to go over this Chinvat bridge into that gloriousness that destiny of grandeur. If one is receptive to let Diana guide one and be there. The guardian spirit, though, will only be there for us if we are there, energized fully on our level. As Plotinus wrote about 1700 years ago in Alexandria, our guardian spirit, our tutorial spirit, is always one level higher than we are. And so when we are full, it's on the next level above fullness. And on that transcendence to fullness is the mystery again. And when we are instructed, when we are guarded by the mystery, what can jeopardize us? Someone pulling into traffic ahead of us? Oh, come on. That's Neo-Babylonian stuff. Worrying about flecks. Next week, thank you.